I too would like to thank Stephanie DeGuyer and Jay Barksdale, and the general crew of the Forsheimers. So I thought this was going to be a straight show and tell. Here's a bunch of pictures of the creature, and it's turned into a paper. So forgive me, there will be pictures eventually. And it is, yeah, it's really called Creature of a Thousand Faces or Not. Whoops. Heard melodies are sweet, but those unheard are sweeter. Therefore, ye soft pipes, play on, not to the sensual ear, but more endeared, pipe to the spirit, ditties of no tone. It's Keats, of course, that's the Ode to the Grecian Urn. On a Grecian Urn, sorry. I begin with a simple question. What do we gain and what do we lose when the creature of Mary Shelley's first novel is visually depicted? The short time between publication in 1818 and theatrical embodiment in 1823 testifies to the novel's imperative to the imagination. The story of the pale student, his pale creature, their multiple killings, their failed attempts at marriage, and their death on the ice inspires the question, what would it be like to see this? My epigraph, familiar to most of you, points the way to the ambivalent answer I'd like to put forward. First, that the creature's face as a textual entity allows the reader a more subtle and moving emotional experience than either the stage or the movies do. And second, that the theatrical and cinematic depictions enable a quite different narrative experience, coarser and more alarming than the books. You will notice that this isn't a particularly original reading either of the novel or its depictions. In fact, it could hardly be more hackneyed. But it is one I can stand by. Although actually I think you may argue, I hope so. And I hope that by exploring some of the reasons why I give it, this may be useful for the rest of the day. For those of you who haven't reread Frankenstein in the last couple of days, let's begin with what we have in the novel's text. The creature comes face to face, as it were, with us, surprisingly few times. Here's the first. It was already 1 a.m. The rain pattered dismally against the panes, and my candle was nearly burnt out when, by the glimmer of the half-extinguished light, I saw the dull yellow eye of the creature open. It breathed hard and with a convulsive motion agitated its limbs. How can I describe my emotions at this catastrophe, or how delineate the wretch whom, with such infinite pains and care, I had endeavored to form? His limbs were in proportion, and I had selected his features as beautiful. Beautiful! Great God! His yellow skin scarcely covered the work of muscles and arteries beneath. His hair was of a lustrous black and flowing, his teeth of a pearly whiteness, but these luxuriances only formed a more horrid contrast with his watery eyes, that seemed almost the same color as the dun-white sockets in which they were set, his shriveled complexion and straight black lips. I'm going to change just to give you something better to look at for a while. This is Mary Shelley's hair from 1814, about 3 years before she began work on Frankenstein. This is the most extended description of the creature's face. Frankenstein abandons him after it, and after a brief second meeting in the morning, he sees the creature no more until he's returning home after his little brother William's death, when he sees a tall form in a clump of trees. A flash of lightning, quote, discovered its shape plainly to me, its gigantic stature and the deformity of its aspect more hideous than belongs to humanity, instantly informed me that it was the wretch, the filthy demon to whom I had given life. Already, Shelley has firmly set up Frankenstein's relation to the creature. Not only is he a terrible father and an artist who takes no pleasure in his creation, but though he acknowledges the creature, he reacts to it as an entirely alien being. I noted very quickly above some of the elements of pure plot parallels between the two. They both wish to marry, they join together in a pursuit and flight that is a far more passionate partnership than any other in the book, and so on. But Mary Shelley also uses, especially during and just before Frankenstein's first encounter with the creature, another less obvious form of parallel between them, by which she promotes the reader's sense of the intimacy of their connection. It's a parallel attention to the bodily experience, especially to the face. Just before Frankenstein brings the creature to life, his own body seems to go to pieces. Who shall conceive the horrors of my secret toil? My limbs now tremble. My eyes swim with the remembrance. But then a resistless and almost frantic impulse urged me forward. I collected bones from charnel houses and with profane fingers meddled with the secrets of the human frame. In a solitary chamber, I kept my workshop of filthy creation. My eyeballs were starting at their sockets in attending to the minutiae of my employment. So he's really falling to bits. The work complete, however, the creature and Frankenstein are again, or for the first time, intact. And the scene I quoted from above proceeds. Other such parallels in the text could be shown, but the point is made. There's a sort of bodily synesthesia that pursues the creator and creature through the book that creates in the reader a sympathetic response to both. The primary emotional perception of the creature, however, belongs to Victor Frankenstein. And when the creature discovers itself, it quite agrees with Frankenstein's assessment of his work. This occurs during his idyll in the forest, learning about human culture from the cottagers Felix and Agatha and her blind father. I had admired the perfect forms, this is the creature speaking, I had admired the forms of my cottagers, their grace, beauty, and delicate complexions, but how was I terrified when I viewed myself in a transparent pool? At first I started back, unable to believe that it was indeed I who was reflected in the mirror. And when I became fully convinced that I was in reality the monster that I am, I was filled with the bitterest sensations of despondence and mortification. Alas, I did not yet entirely know the fatal effects of this miserable deformity. Shelley's overwhelming emphasis on the horror and ugliness of the creature's face secondarily, it is on the pity that comes from that horror. She has powerful instruments by which to convey both the horror and the pity. Above all, she has the first-person narrative, which, though somewhat clumsily, puts the reader in both Frankenstein's and then the creature's subject positions. The novel is a nested set of first-person narratives, some written and some spoken, and the two longest are those of Frankenstein and the creature. The reader thus enters the consciousness of both for fairly long stretches of the novel, and both creature and creator are eloquent in conveying their emotions. Within the series of nested narratives, by far the most touching is the episode of the creature's education. You'll remember that he finds copies of Plutarch, Milton, and Goethe's Sorrows of Young Werther, which he reads with avidity and which produce in him an infinity of new images and feelings. This accidental education is so moving, in part because it responds to every child's wish to be saved, to be cherished, to be given all that one needs. Education here is the mother's milk that neither the creature nor Mary Shelley received. Just as the 18th century politician John Wilkes, notorious for his womanizing and his ugliness, said, "Give me half an hour with any woman and I'll talk away my face," the creature in the novel talks away his. The tale is told during the long tete-a-tete between the creature and Frankenstein on the Mer de Glace. It ends with Frankenstein losing what has become a quite Godwinian argument, in which the creature promises to live a vegetarian life in the wilds of America with his mate, far from the eyes of human beings, among whom he does not count himself. Victor agrees to make him a mate, then changes his mind. Then, at the creature's last eloquent speech, nearly changes it back again. The creature's appearance is what dissuades him, against the emphasis on the face, quite irrationally. But then, at last, his sense of political justice kicks in, and he does indeed change his mind. His words had a strange effect on me. I compassionated him, and sometimes felt a wish to console him. But when I looked on him, when I saw the filthy mass that moved and talked, my heart sickened, and my feeling was altered to those of horror and hatred. I tried to stifle them. I thought that, as I could not sympathize with him, I had no right to refuse him the small portion of happiness that I had it in my power to bestow. After a long pause, I concluded that the justice due both him and my fellow creatures demanded of me that I should comply with his request. The creature's tale retains its emotional power over the reader long after Frankenstein has lost patience for him and his demand for a mate, creating a disparity of sympathy between the reader and Frankenstein and a corrosive feeling of irony. One wants to say throughout sort of the last half of the novel, "You fool, Victor, he's a better man than you." And he is. But while one feels that the creation of this disparity was intentional on Shelley's part, The power of the first-person narrative puts a brake on the degree to which the novel can allow us to sympathize with the creature. Although the sympathy aroused by the proximity of experience never quite disappears, the moment when Frankenstein destroys the creature's bride marks a final turn towards the deathly for both of them. It is as if the creature were too good a Godwinian philosopher to be allowed to win. This is perhaps one of the secrets of the novel's enduring grip. The creature has both reason and sympathy on his side, but Victor has, on his, the instinctual antagonism against the horror that he has created. If the creature had retained its power of speech in Richard Brinsley Peake's 1823 adaptation, which this is an 1827 playbill for, the shifting point of view would have been also preserved, but a speechless creature is truly handicapped. Nor do the enacted versions attempt, mostly, to reproduce the powerful and self-contradictory irony that pervades Shelley's depiction of Victor Frankenstein. Once the creature has been muted, he loses this grip on our affections, and a number of changes in the dominant tone take place. The first casualty is the feeling of kinship with the creature. The second is our kinship with Victor Frankenstein, which has grown after the narrative returns to his point of view. The third is the peculiar ambiguity of the novel itself, with its uncertain pointing to Victor as the hero. But loss is not the whole tale. I said I would also describe what's gained in the transfer to the stage and screen, and one has to say that what's gained first is humor. There's not a funny moment in the whole book, but in Peake's fabulously successful Presumption or The Fate of Frankenstein, stock figures of comedy appear, the stupid servant and his marginally more clever wife, who sing funny songs and are given comic turns right through the disappearance of little William, which is to say, because it's hugely compressed, nearly the end of the play. Among the five different settings of the play in 1823 alone, several were flat-out comedies, one a farce by Peake himself called Another Piece of Presumption, in which the characters have names like Frankenstitch, Frizzy, Shovelhat, Hobgoblin, and so on. The creature, unable now to talk away its face, had to change, and it too became funny. Even its first illustration from 1831 shows the creature comically confounded at its own existence. The black lips, yellow skin, dun sockets are all loathsome on this page, but on the stage, the creature would just look jaundiced. So when Peake dramatized the novel, which these are two pictures, this one you've seen on the handouts for this day, and this one, both depict Thomas Potter Cook playing the creature, which he did for years. It was really the role of his lifetime. And this is from the French version, which was also massively popular and sort of re-imported and translated. So when Peake dramatized the novel, the creature became blue and acquired a toga and a general noble savage appearance. The blueness may have been in reference to the Picts, the ancient, you know, savage Celtic people who were said to tattoo or dye their skin blue, or perhaps it's simply to emphasize the creature's distance from humanity. A review in the Times of London described him as bursting onto the stage 5 minutes after its birth, a tall, light blue figure with a white face and long black hair. Blue skin is creepy, but it can also be funny. And yet, Peake had it both ways. In the play's longest quotation from the novel, almost the only part where he just rips off Mary Shelley directly, he has Frankenstein read the original yellow, black, dun, white description of the creature. But of course, our most familiar image of the creature is not funny. At least, it wasn't until it became a cliché. Even without speech, point of view is more easily conveyed in the cinema than on the stage. But James Whale's paradigmatic 1931 film production, the articulated consciousness of both figures is reduced to something close to brutality. That is, the creature can't speak, but neither do Frankenstein or his assistant Fritz, who's imported from the play, spend much time trying to teach it. The creature's longest experience of culture is torture under Fritz's torch and whip. And yet there are a few moments in Whale's film in which the close-up of the creature, and I know these are just publicity stills, allows him, if not to speak, at least to intimate the misery he endures and a certain incredulity at his treatment. After Carla, the creature seemed for a long time to have only one face, and you might reasonably think that this was the face I had in mind when I titled this essay. I was thinking more, though, about how Mary Shelley represents Frankenstein as misreading his creature, insisting that it has only one possible expression, that of a malevolent grin. But a face, unlike any other text, can instantly correct a misreading, and she allows the creature to have his say. Once he's been abstracted from the story, the creature becomes a shorthand reference to anything overgrown or misshapen or not quite what one expected. In Britain in the 19th century, this often meant that the creature was put to the service of racist or xenophobic purposes, as here. Wait, this is actually what they based Karloff's face on. It's a picture of the golem from a 1920 film production. Again, that's from the 31. Sorry. This is an early-ish 1827 political cartoon showing, it was a political scandal of payoffs in return for titles. But you see that Frankenstein is already, you know, there's no visual thing. It's the thing of making a man that's important. And in others, this is Tenniel in 1866 representing the creature as working class Birmingham, that is Brummagem, agitator, and John Bright of the activists, Cobden and Bright, is saying, "I have no fear of manhood suffrage." So this is one of the Irish Frankensteins where he's vaguely simian, vaguely frog-like, and actually more frightening than almost any other image I know. But that's from 1869. Tenniel, again, who seems to have loved this, in 1882 makes an Irish Frankenstein that's closer to what you'd expect from the stage version. And finally, I just thought I'd show this partly as a lead-in to Paul's, so I don't know, is this going to feature? Okay. This is the 1910 Edison Kinetoscope, the first movie adaptation of Frankenstein. And this is the Armed Services edition. I was just sort of thinking, what can I show you? Don't do that. I wanted to end with Odile Norvodon. This was not meant to represent Frankenstein at all, the creature, that is. But it's, I have to say, my favorite image of it. So these are, as Stephanie said, only a few of the hundreds of possible images of the creature. But they suggest, at least to me, the lasting iconic fertility of its face. It's now the custom to see the creature in multiple ways. Film and stage treatments of the novel number in hundreds, and one of the most recent, Danny Boyle's two-man version with the estimable Benedict Cumberbatch and Johnny Lee Miller, in which the creature is very much in possession of his own narrative, will be discussed by others today. I've gone on far too long about faces. I hope that at least I begin to point at how extraordinarily suggestive the novel is. Its writing may lumber at times, but its idea is never less than thrilling.